Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 252, recorded for the week of March 20th, 2024. I have an InfluxDB of AI-related stories. Good evening, Ryan, Matt, and Jonathan. Full house!
Wow! Yeah. Woo-hoo. Second week in a row.
I know. And even better, Matt's here coming live from a Seve outage. So he's a... You might have to disappear at any moment if something comes up, but yeah, we do appreciate you sacrificing the fact that you've been up since some like 4 a.m. to come talk to us about cloud news, which will just be a stimulating. Oh, 1
a.m. Yeah. No, 1 a.m., which was like
1 a.m.
1 a.m., which is like 10 p.m. for you.
Yeah, see, that's great. So
it's Azure, though. You don't need to worry about things coming back up.
Yeah.
Don't get there.
It'll eventually come back up. You just don't know when. That's the... It's reality. I sometimes worry about GCP too, so I feel your pain.
It happens on everything.
We don't have any AI news this week. Well, we do, but it's just not worthy of being broken out into its own section. So we're going to hit the AI news as we go through the cloud providers. And first up is, guess what? Amazon. And guess who what they're announcing this week after they announced Sonnet last week? They're back with Claude 3 Haiku, which I cannot say a haiku or write one. This is a failure of my schooling, you can now get the Sonnet and the Haiku on the Bedrock. So I expect next week, because the way that Amazon is stretching this out for as long as humanly possible, we will get Opus next week. Mm-hmm. And so that'd be great. But the Haiku model, for those of you who are interested, is the fastest and most compact model of the Claude 3 family, designed for near instant responsiveness and seamless generative AI experiences that mimic human interaction, as long as that human is stupid. Because it doesn't have enough time to actually process anything because it's too busy trying to be near instantly responsive to you.
Well, I find the fact that, you know, all the prompts into it have to be, you know, in 575 format to be kind of cumbersome to use.
So. Yeah, it is a bit of a limitation.
You stole my joke.
I haven't tried Haiku, but I've played with Sonnet a lot for free over the past week. It's very good. But yeah, it's much better conversationally. I mean, I'm not talking about technical things. Like, I ask all kinds of random, you know, philosophical questions or whatever, just to kind of explore what it can do, what it knows. And it's, I'm going to say, if I was going to spend money on OpenAI or Anthropic, it will be on Anthropic right now.
Hmm. Well, we'll have to see what you say after GPT 4.5 comes out, which apparently is imminent.
Definitely delete to this week. I don't know what you're talking about.
I mean, is it racially biased, though, or woke? That's the most important question we need to ask about all the LLMs.
Everyone's racially biased. Yes. Everyone. In some way.
You weren't here to talk about that. You missed that episode where we talked about wokeness of GCP. Mm-hmm. Or not.
I mean, yeah, the image creation thing is kind of funny. I see it more as humorous than...
Definitely humorous.
Terrible.
Yeah, it's not a sign of like the bit rot of all of Google's culture. I don't see that part of it. But yeah, their explanation of what happened there made perfect sense to me. I'm like, I can see what you were trying to do. You were trying to be more thoughtful, and you just overplayed your hand. That's okay.
Yeah. Well, it's like anything with AI, right? This is brand new. We don't have rules and established patterns. And I thought what they were trying to do was noble, right? It definitely didn't work out, but you know, you roll it back, you move forward.
Yeah, they'll learn and they'll get better.
Kind of reminded me of the Ford ad. I'm not sure it was the 80s or the 90s where it was like a billboard with a whole bunch of supposed Ford workers on. And depending on the country that the billboards were placed in, they'd photoshopped out some races of people to make it, you know, appropriate for the culture. I was like, So what Google did is the opposite of that, presumably.
Well, today is officially the 20th, but last week was Pi Day on the 14th, 3/14. And since this just passes by last week, Amazon, of course, was back with a live stream on the 14th, which you can go find, I believe, in their archive on Twitch, where they explored AWS storage from data lake to high-performance storage and how to transform your data strategy to, you guessed it, generative AI readiness. So if you were desperate for that information, it's out there available to you. But in honor of Pi Day, they did announce several new storage features, including S3 connectors for PyTorch, S3 on Outpost, the S3 CSI driver for Bottle Rocket, and EFS file system throughput increases of 2x. Again, I love when they use 2x or 50% or because, you know, it really helps me baseline where the performance was versus what you are now improving it to. But I do still appreciate it that they tried.
So what's awesome about that CSI driver is that we can run SQL Server in Kubernetes with the files being stored in S3 for all that. There's like, it'll be awesome.
What could go wrong?
Yeah.
I can see so much success.
All I just heard was CSI Miami and CSI, Las Vegas. Like, my brain's not waking up, but that's where my brain went when you said CSI.
To be fair, that's where my brain went the first time as well. So I was like, yeah.
I also didn't realize that S3 Outpost wasn't a thing yet. I swear that I thought that was released a long time ago.
It was definitely a thing. So I'm confused with this. Yeah.
I mean, are you questioning my ability to summarize 6,000 words of garbage into something?
Yeah, it was questioning your ability to edit the AI response that you did.
Amazon, sorry, they didn't underline this part, so I didn't catch it. Amazon S3 and Outpost authentication caching. By securely caching authentication authorization data for Amazon S3 locally on the Outpost rack, this new capability removes round trips to the parent AWS region for every request. See, it was better off just thinking they didn't have it before.
Yeah. Wait, hold on. So if you had to authenticate to your S3 bucket that was on-prem,
you had to go back to the cloud.
You still had to have full, you had to go back to the cloud, which probably defeats the purpose of having local S3 and some of the benefits of Alpha.
I mean, it eliminates the latency of writing the file to the cloud. You do have that extra headwind of negotiating with the IAM service first.
Or so, there's the audit concern of having data on-premises, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyways, happy Pi Day. It's always a good one.
The real question is, did you eat pie?
I did not.
I did.
Mm. Oh, did you? I'm jealous because I didn't. And I felt really guilty about it. Yeah. I like, silly traditions like this. It's fun. And I forgot to mention it all day at work, too. I would have tortured my team with, pie references. What kind of
cherry?
Well, let's put an Outlook calendar invite in. And then we can remember this for next year so we can be properly prepared, like to order pie and have pie on the podcast.
This was a good idea.
Maybe we could live stream that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Just throwing it out there. We could be a competitive Twitch stream on just the Cloud Pot Eats Pie. mocking the pie live stream.
It's like the fun. Puppy Bowl during the Super Bowl.
Or the SpongeBob version of the Super Bowl. That was pretty good, too.
I've never seen that.
Oh, yes. They had a simulcast of the Super Bowl, which was SpongeBob. And so SpongeBob was explaining... Or actually, it was all Nintendo cartoon, Nickelodeon cartoon characters. And so they would come on screen and be like, this is what offsides means. And so I was like, wow, you'll love it. All right, back to the news. You can now use InfluxDB as the database engine behind Amazon Timestream. The support makes it easy for you to run the near real-time time series applications using InfluxDB and open source APIs, including open source Telegraph agents that collect time series observations. This is the second engine supported in Timestream, with the first now being known as Timestream for Live Analytics, which is a terrible name. Amazon says that you should use InfluxDB engine if your use case requires near real-time time series queries or specific features in InfluxDB, such as Flux queries. If you are needing to ingest more than tens of gigabits of time series data per minute and run SQL queries on petabytes of time series data in seconds, they still recommend you use Timestream for Live Analytics. There's a quote here from Paul Dix, founder and CTO of Influx Data. The future of open source is powered by the public cloud. Reaching the broadest community through simple entry points and practical user experience, Amazon Timestream for InfluxDB delivers on that vision. Our partnership with AWS turns InfluxDB open source into a force multiplier for real-time insights on time series data, making it easier than ever for developers to build and scale their time series workloads on AWS. The pricing on these is sort of complex, so I'll try to summarize this as best I can. Pricing for Live Analytics, you pay 50 cents per 1 million writes of 1 kilobyte size. You pay a penny per gigabyte scanned in queries, and you pay 3.5 pennies per gigabyte stored per hour in memory, and 3 pennies for magnetic storage. This also includes a free tier, which allows you to receive 50 gigs of ingestion, 100 gigs of magnetic tier storage, and 750 gigs of memory storage, and 750 gigs of query usage. Versus the Influx model, which is on two dimensions, either single AZ or multi-AZ deployment option, and the two dimensions are instances and database storage. The Influx multi-AZ goes from one CPU by 8 gigabytes of memory all the way up to 64 CPUs and 512 gigs of memory, and will cost you between 23 cents and $15.30 per hour between those two extremes. Data storage is broken into IOPS sizing. So 3,000 IOPS with a minimum of 20 gigabytes of space is at 20 cents per gigabyte per month. For 12,000 IOPS is a minimum of 400 gigabytes at 70 cents per gigabyte per month. And for 16,000 IOPS, it's at 400 gigabyte minimum at $1 per gigabyte per month. So do the math before you buy.
Sweet Jesus. No wonder there's a FinOps like specialty.
Yeah, Ryan, stop being in my head today, Ryan. Stop it. Literally was going to say that. I also was going to make a joke about carrying the two.
So this is what happens when you get sleep deprived. You dumb down to my level.
I was just going to go with, so carry the two, multiply times three, and this is why we have FinOps.
Yeah. And the Amazon calculator.
I had the joke all lined up, which I'm sure is actually going to be helpful.
Yeah.
The question is, do they even have the InfluxDB in the Amazon calculator? Because in the past, it's always been very delayed.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be a couple weeks. I am sort of surprised they went with live analytics versus serverless time series, because what they're saying, they're describing is basically a time stream serverless server. Because you don't have to worry about servers, you just worry about compute and storage and things in memory. But apparently they decided not to use the serverless moniker for live analytics.
Oh, so maybe it doesn't scale down to zero and they've learned their lesson and not calling it serverless? Because
maybe. Don't know.
That would be,
I think what's a shame about this is that, the API changes. So although time streams is the service, the API is different, whether you use the live analytics or InfluxDB. It would have been nice, I think, if they'd actually implemented the old API, so you could still talk to Influx with the old API, so you could actually migrate to the new engine without actually having to update code.
That would be nice, but why would we do such a thing?
I don't know. I mean, the main migration's easy enough, at least. You can export between the two through S3, or you can bring in Influx from outside easily enough, but it would have been nice.
Seems like one of those things like this, there's a reason. This feels not like an oversight to me. This feels like a very, because this is a very specific sort of versioning of those two things, or offering of those two things rather. So I don't know. It feels like there's an architectural concern that we don't know about from our side.
Yeah, probably. I mean, there's probably not many people, like if you were happy with the API that Live Analytics gave you, then you probably didn't need the things that Time Stream gives you anyway.
Mm.
So I just real-time follow-up here. I did go to the calculator.
So did I.
The configure, and I have to say that I have never actually been in this calculator before, and this may be the most complicated calculator I've ever seen. So you have to either just give it the record size, or it gets you calculate the record size, and they ask you for record type, number of dimensions, approximate size of each dimensional value, the number of big int double timestamp measures, number of Boolean measures, number of varchar measures, and the approximate size of each varchar measure you want to do. And I'm like, you lost me at big int and how many of those I was going to have. And then it goes into memory store, and you're like, okay, this should be easier, right? Number of records per month. Is it batch data or not batch data? I don't know. What's your batch size? 100 is the default. And then percentage of repeated data per batch. Oh my God, I have no idea.
Yeah.
Same kind of questions for magnetic store writes. And then it gets into queries, and it goes, do you have scheduled queries or without scheduled queries? Number of queries per month, per year, whatever you want to do there. Average time range of data queried by the queries. Like, I would know that. Number of ad hoc queries. Number average time range of data queried by ad hoc queries. And number of alerting, dashboarding, and point in time queries that you need to use. All on a per month, per minute, per year basis. And man, I'm going to need a PhD on this one.
Yeah. I love you're trying to evaluate whether or not you can use a new service. You want to make sure that, it's not cost prohibitive. It's sort of like,
I mean, I think InfluxDB is going to be cheaper just because it's going to take me less time to work out this calculator.
Right. Just cost savings. Yeah.
But does the CFO actually care about your time, or does he only care about what the bill is?
I mean, I don't know. Depends on your hourly rate, I guess. Mm-hmm.
I will say this calculator has added a ton more services. Because I remember when they first released it, I was doing a calculator for a map project, and there was like 8 services only in here. It felt like they're like, what about like network firewall? No, that's not in there. Just throw a couple, M5 larges in there. Call it firewall service. Like anything was just like throw some more compute in there. Call it or just label it as the service. So. It's nice to see that they actually are updating this to support all the different, actual options.
It's nice that they added bulk import though, because before it was like you got to click through the console and you couldn't save any progress, and like you click out of the page and go back again, you've lost everything. So it's nice that you can actually generate your quote, like the manifest of the items that you want, and then import it into the calculator. That was, I'm not sure when they added that, but that's an awesome feature because that was very painful before.
I vaguely remember it going by and I killed it as a story topic because I was like, who cares about batch and time stream? real-time data that needs to be batched? I don't think anyone wants to talk about that. So I didn't talk about it. Well, you know, if you didn't like burning your money through time series, Amazon and NVIDIA will soon be here with a new way for you to burn all of the monies. AWS and NVIDIA are announcing that the new NVIDIA Blackwell GPU platform, unveiled by NVIDIA at GTC 2024, is coming to AWS. AWS will offer the NVIDIA GB200 Grace Blackwell Superchip and the B100 Tensor Core GPUs, extending the company's longstanding strategic collaboration to deliver the most secure and advanced infrastructure, software, and services to help customers unlock new generative AI capabilities. AWS will offer these later this year via their EC2 Ultra clusters and the Amazon EC2 capacity blocks for ML offerings. And the GB200 will also be available on the NVIDIA DGX Cloud platform, which is built, of course, on top of AWS because it was co-engineered between the two companies. So you can pay a markup to Amazon, you know, to NVIDIA and AWS, or you can just pay it to AWS if you can get the capacity blocks for it. So good luck to you on that. There is a quote here from Adam Slipsky, CEO at AWS. The deep collaboration between our two organizations goes back more than 13 years. And when together, we launched the world's first GPU cloud instance on AWS. And today we offer the widest range of NVIDIA GPU solutions for our customers. NVIDIA's next generation Grace Blackwell processor marks a significant step forward in generative AI and GPU computing. And combined with AWS's powerful Elastic Fabric Adapter Networking, Amazon EC2 Ultra Cluster Hyperscale Clustering, and our unique Nitro Systems Advanced Virtualization and Security Capabilities, we make it possible for customers to build and run multi-trillion parameter large language models faster, at massive scale, and more securely than anywhere else. Together, we continue to innovate to make AWS the best place to run NVIDIA GPUs in the cloud.
Yeah, wonderful marketing language in there. Just to remind you that AWS have been working with ML for a very long time, much longer than anybody else, 13 years. And the reason they have the broadest range of NVIDIA hardware is because they've been buying it for the longest, and half of it's ancient.
Yeah. But if you don't need the fastest and best, you can get the cheap old stuff.
Yeah.
Hey, I had a client that ran all of his dev boxes on Spot M1 larges or whatever, M1 mediums, because he never lost them.
Yeah. Yes, he did not. He also is running on basically my laptop from 20 years ago.
That was all his remote developers needed, though. So
makes sense. Make it work.
I am intrigued by the fact that this thing is going to run a multi-trillion parameter large language models. And all I can think about is the capture is just going brrr.
Yeah, no kidding.
Because yeah. I don't think we even have a trillion parameter large language model that's at least publicly available that I'm aware of. But a multi-trillion one is even more fascinating to me.
And the lights will dim when this turns on.
That's when they need that new nuclear powered plant data center.
I was just wondering if that actually becomes a line item on their financial reporting. Like, we ran 5 multi-trillion line, and this costs, you know, several billion dollars to run, and therefore this is actually a level of importance that we have to denote on our, you know, financial reporting.
The people training multi-trillion or more parameter models right now are government entities.
And Google and Microsoft. Google. That's it. Because no one's going to afford it. People. I just did a Google search for it live, real-time fill-up. So January 8th, 2024, there was an article in datacenterdynamics.com, which I don't know this website. Frontier supercomputer trains 1 trillion parameter LM on just over 3,000 GPUs, and it says researchers at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. And I'm like, oh, yes. Okay, thank you, FBI, CIA, for letting us know you have this. Appreciate it. Oak Ridge is code.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's move on to GCP, where an interesting show note came up on here that says, Jonathan does a thing, --, Google support. So, Jonathan, I guess I'm going to turn this over to your capable British tones.
Yeah. I'm not one to complain. Actually, that's a complete lie.
Well, let's see. That's the first lie of the podcast today.
I thought you were saying the first lie of the segment that you talked about.
Oh, yeah. The segment. Yes, that too. Yeah.
I just had the worst experience at Google support. It's not Google Cloud. It's just Google in general. And we should actually rename the section, you know, Jonathan looks forward to AI actually replacing Google support people, because it just couldn't have gotten any worse than it was. But so the brief backstory is my wife and I have had Pixel phones or Android phones since they first came out, like 2009. And so, her phone got knocked out of her hand. It broke the screen, broke the back. It's insured. That's great. We swapped it out. did a like a device protect replacement kind of thing. The one we got sent was didn't work right. Like fingerprint reader didn't work, just connectivity was wrong. That's fine. So first she contacts Google because it's her phone, it's registered to her in her Google Fi account. She contacts Google, spends an hour with their Google support until they've already got almost got the RMA ready to go. They're like, oh, actually you didn't buy this. You've got to get the person who bought it to open the ticket. So there's 1 hour wasted. So I'm like, okay, I'll contact them from my own account. So I contact them. Same questions over again. They couldn't pull any information from the original ticket because, you know, that's a different person, whatever. I get that. Like 45 minutes goes by. Yes, we've given them all the information, you know, the IMEI numbers and everything else. I even gave like the order number from buying the thing in the Google store. And like, oh, actually, I can't help you because this is a warranty replacement. And so it's actually handled by a different team. I'm like, no, don't send me to somebody else. Finally, they're like, okay, I'll see what I can do. I'll throw you a bone. So like we're at the hour mark now. And the support person pastes an RMA number into the chat and says, this is the link you need to follow. You go to the store, you click the link. We'll send you a replacement in advance. Put a hold on the credit card. We'll sit, you know, return the broken one. That's great. Okay. So like, there's 1 hour gone. Hang up the call. Save the transcript, thankfully, which I will publish. Click on the link. Doesn't work. It says, you know, it's like pre-signed key kind of thing. It's like, oh, this link is not for your account. I'm like, okay, well, maybe it was my podcast account somehow that the ticket got opened in. Nope, wasn't that one. Tried another account that I've got, wasn't that one. So back in touch with Google support again. I'm like, okay, I got sent this RMA number. This is the number. The link doesn't work. And I spent the next hour and a half with going round and round with the support people refusing to help me. So like, well, that RMA number isn't linked to one of your accounts. You need to disconnect and reconnect with the email address that you created the RMA through. I'm like, this was the address I created the RMA through. I tried all these three different accounts, listed them all out. Well, sorry, I can't help you. The other thing you can do is disconnect and retry with another thing. Over and over again, we went through this whole process until like an hour and 50 minutes. And I'm like, what would you do exactly if I called and said I never received the email with the RMA number in? And like, ah, well, then we'd issue you a new one. Like, well, why don't you do that then?
Wow.
So they canceled the RMA that I actually pasted them in the chat. So I thought, right, you know, I have to apologize to whoever actually can't get their replacement device because their RMA got canceled because of me. But yeah, they did eventually reissue the RMA. And I did eventually manage to order a new replacement device. But it's just like the complete lack of actually wanting to help me as a customer solve the problem, which was that the link they sent didn't work. I referred back to the previous ticket. I was like, read through my other ticket. Here it is. This is the number. You can see that this was the number I was given. What's going on? Now can't help you. Disconnect and try with another account. Like it's just absolutely horrendous as a customer experience. And if I hadn't kind of had my own experience being on the receiving end of, asshole customers, I probably would have, I wouldn't have known how to proceed with that. I would have disconnected and thought, what do I do now? Kind of thing. So that was just very disappointing. And I responded to the Google, you know, how likely are you to recommend a Google hardware based on the support experience? And like the answer was zero. Yeah. Absolutely horrendous. Like it should have been a wizard to click through the website, or it could have been an AI chatbot. It could have been anything that would have done that properly. But human intervention was just slowed me down. Like a 5-minute task took 3 hours in total of people time, and just so frustrating. That was my thing.
Well, I mean, you did say that it was, you know, related to Google Pixel, but I do think I've had that experience also with Google Cloud. So, you know, it's not that far off.
Yeah.
They train them in the same camps.
Yeah. And originally I was like, oh, I should try and defend them. I mean, they're a huge company. They've got billions of customers. It must be very hard to run, you know, a call center at scale to handle the volume of queries that they get. But then I thought, nah, this is just a nonsense thing. Like very specifically, the problem I had, somebody should have said, okay, somebody pasted you the wrong RMA number. Let's just go back and redo it. Well, like, it was just the complete disbelief in what I was saying as a customer. Just a dismissiveness of it that just really, really annoyed me.
I mean, Ryan, I think, can tell you about his time he wanted to provision a server, you know, an N2. And then they told him they didn't believe him, that, you know, no one wants an N2 server. And so, you know, that's just how it works.
Yeah. No, there is capacity. No, there's not capacity. No, there is capacity. Well, there's not capacity.
Are you sure there's?
Oh, you have a custom shape. Oh, yeah, I have a custom shape. That's in the request I sent you.
Yeah, it was in the original details. It's sort of like this other project I'm working on where, you know, they told us we should do this one thing and we gave them all the requirements. And then when they transitioned, they realized they didn't want to offer us that thing anymore. They wanted to switch us over. They just dropped one of the key requirements, which then burned us pretty hard. Yeah, I'm familiar with GCP and not listening to their clients because they're right and we're wrong. So, well, apparently an area where they did listen to us this time, though, is you can now build and run SSRS reports with databases hosted on Cloud SQL for SQL Server, including the report server database required to set up and actually run SSRS, which was kind of one of those weird wrinkles. If you had a separate SSRS server that you were managing, you could at one point have it deploy SSRS reports to databases in Cloud SQL, but then you could never touch them again. It was cool, super cool. So glad to have this now officially, I guess, if you're running SSRS, which is basically their fancy version of ETL, which Google has better options. Go look there.
Fun fact, you can't run SSRS in Microsoft SQL managed service.
Really?
Yeah.
Shocker.
Doesn't actually at all.
That's because they want you to buy Fabric.
Slightly agitate. No, this was before they had Fabric.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, now they'll just sell you Fabric and be like, hey, look at this plethora of tools that do a bajillion things when all you want to do is use a simple Power BI dashboard. Cool. Yeah, can I just do the Power BI thing? No, you need the data flow and you need the pipeline and you need the conversion thingy and you need all these other pieces to make simple things work. It's cool. I really like Azure. It's a great product.
Great. I'm in love with it today.
Yeah. How's that outage going for you? Yeah. Okay, sorry.
I might have been on mute when I was on the 7-day outage line. Someone asked me about why we're talking about Pi right now. So my response was, you all have to listen to the podcast. Nice. Week. So somebody has to remind me next week when we post this, when we record next week, that I have to send the link to my team.
There you go. Perfect. Well, Google can be a winner in some things, and that winner is the Forrester Wave AI Infrastructure Solutions for Q1 2024, and they're winning so hard. So far to the upper right that everyone else is almost a distant second. I love this quote from Forrester Wave they put into the article. Google has strengths across the board with the highest scores of all the vendors in this evaluation. Wow, thank you. Thank you for that. And Google, even better, highlighted that in their article, which I found hilarious. But going into the real meat of it, I went and filled out the NAG screen and gave my email address to be harassed by my Google sales rep. But basically, I now know that the Forrester Wave has leaders, Google, AWS, Microsoft, NVIDIA, and surprise entry, Dell, as a leader in the space. Strong performers were IBM and HPE, which again, I don't think they know what strong performer means when you refer to those two companies. Contenders were Alibaba Cloud, Lenovo, and Oracle. And the challengers were some company called Graphcore and Cerebras Systems, which I had heard of, so I give them a pass. You know, looking through this, a couple of things that jumped out at me. Google, they said in a little more detail, Google offers the whole package of AI workloads. Doing AI efficiently at Google scale is a feat that few other companies in the world are capable of. Google brings that experience and infrastructure to Google Cloud AI infrastructure, and Google's early ongoing investments in AI for its other businesses drives its vision of where the puck is going to be for enterprise AI. Okay, Forrester. Microsoft got Microsoft makes supercomputer AI infrastructure easy to use at cloud scale. Microsoft offers numerous sizes of GPU-optimized virtual machines for direct use, and the Azure AI portfolio offers several AI-centric services such as Azure OpenAI Service and Azure AI Studio to help customers develop custom AI applications that use Microsoft's underlying AI infrastructure. And their strategy is to bring AI to every application, every business process, and every employee and charge you $30 per user per month forever for every one of them.
Copilot.
And then,
Copilot somewhere.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah.
Amazon Web Services as your one-stop AI shop with a wide range of options. AWS AI infrastructure portfolio is extensive, and AWS vision is to offer customers a wide range of options to run AI workloads from pre-configured instances to training services abstracted behind its AI development tool, Amazon SageMaker. It also offers you a bunch of things like Trainium and blah, blah, blah. And then I had to go check out, see what they had to say about Oracle. And they say, Oracle offers you cost-effective AI infrastructure, but needs more tooling. Oracle has emerged as an attractive cloud AI infrastructure provider because it has a mature public cloud, a breadth of complementary AI services, and the hardware horsepower to back it up. In addition, because of its huge enterprise application business, enterprises already have plenty of training data in the Oracle Cloud, which that just gives me shivers. Let's give our Oracle training data from our Oracle ERP system. Great. Oh. What could go wrong?
It's a huge missed opportunity for the podcast title, Forest and Wave. Where the puck is AI?
Missed opportunities.
We'll have to save that one. That one we can use later.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, the other big thing in this one was, of course, they mentioned Dell. So I had to go see what they had to say about Dell, because that just made no sense to me whatsoever.
HPE too. I was also like, really? What?
Yep.
These things are not like the others.
So Dell offers AI-ready architecture for all, could benefit from more development tools, though. Running a solution such as PowerFlex and PowerScale, Dell's superior vision is to offer the quickest, most integrated solution to enterprises for on-premise and co-location deployments. The company can improve its roadmap and innovation with more AI-specific tooling. So you're saying that they're a leader because they offer you servers that have GPUs? That's what? A low bar.
Wow.
And then HPE, they said, powers AI from edge to cloud, but needs sharper messaging. Hewlett Packard Enterprises offers a broad range of hardware configurations from edge to supercomputer that can support AI workloads, and customers can use the HPE GreenLake to make it all work as a private cloud. Well, thanks for that. Appreciate it.
Yeah. I mean, that's all it is. It's just a hardware management layer, which is, you know, great if you're running a data center, you know, that's good, but it's just compute. It's nothing fancy. So like, it seems like a weird to include them in the category.
Kind of wonder if like, did they pay for other Forrester Wave analysts to work on things, and they just throw their names into other reports as a favor?
Well, they probably do it with AI, so maybe it's just a hallucination.
Compaq has the best GPUs out there.
Oh, Compaq. We're going to talk about, what was the, Digital. Digital main, Unix was my favorite. Until they killed it. All right. Next up is unifying analytics with Spark procedures and BigQuery, now generally available, which made no sense to me. So I had to go read the article multiple times. BigQuery, of course, is a highly scalable and capable SQL engine, and Google will tell you it's the best. However, you may want to leverage open source Apache Spark expertise or existing Spark-based business logic to expand BigQuery data processing beyond SQL. For example, there may be a package designed by Ryan to handle complex JSON processing or graph data processing, or there may be legacy code written by Matt that was written in Spark prior to your migration to BigQuery. And historically, this would require you to leave BigQuery, enable a separate API, and use an alternative UI, manage disparate permissions, and pay for a non-BigQuery SKU. And to fix all of this, they're extending BigQuery data processing to Apache Spark and announcing the GA of Apache Spark stored procedures. Come on now. In BigQuery. Man. BigQuery users looking to extend their queries with Spark-based data processing can now use BigQuery APIs to create and execute Spark stored procedures. It brings Spark together with BigQuery under a single experience, including management, security, and billing. And of all the branding names you guys came up with, stored procedures is what you just chose. Yeah. Come on.
I think I just had PTSD from stored procedures. Like, my whole body shivered a little bit.
I mean, it makes sense. It's kind of what it is.
It is kind of what it is. I got what they used it, but I was like, really? You didn't focus group this? Because, you know, the first thing I think of was BigQuery is stored procedures.
Yeah. What's cool, though, is it's not just like SQL stored procedures. You can actually write like code in a sensible language. So you can write stored procedures in Python if you want.
I mean, technically, you can write Java inside of Oracle stored procedures and compile them. So
what's
the difference?
I just cried a little bit. Yeah, I just died a little bit. Just a little bit.
I know. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very neat feature that I could find six ways to use tomorrow. Worry about like long term supportability in the same ways, but that again, like I think I'm just triggered by the name.
This is like the Postgres trigger that automatically could trigger a Lambda. Where I'm like, this is really cool. There's a lot of cool things you can do with this, but please never use this.
Yeah.
Like, or don't call it a trigger. Just call it an event. Yeah. So data update event occurred in the Postgres database. Then I'm okay. If you call it a trigger, I'm not so sure
that I want my SQL database to find.
Well, it's part of the commit though, right?
Like, it just feels bad. Yeah. Like, there's something about this.
Yeah, it's a Lambda that's parsing the data is the idea and part of the commit. So it's not like it's just triggering some other distributed workflow.
It might. You could delete Lambda.
I mean, I guess you could do whatever you want. Yeah,
I have Lambda Spackle stickers. You could do whatever you want with it.
It's very similar to Lambda, honestly. It's a Databricks serverless service for Spark that they're just integrated with to provide the functionality. So mm-hmm. very similar to Lambda, built in the same way.
Can you go back to Ryan's comment? Cool feature, long-term support. I will do this right when I'm getting ready to leave a company. It'll be someone else's problem.
Sorry, all right, I'm going to make a note for the CCOA. Yeah. We will not approve stored procedures for BigQuery.
Yeah. Yeah.
Auto reject.
Save company from horrible mistake.
Well, wait. Can I take my SQL Server stored procedures and put them into BigQuery natively? Like, do I have to translate them or can I just plug them in? Because maybe this is the solution to all of our problems.
Yeah. How much money you got, though?
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to Azure. Who's here with free data transfer out when leaving Azure, which could be mad after today. Microsoft supports customer choice, including the choice to migrate your data away from Azure. Of course, that's only when the European Union is telling you you must provide this capability. They're now offering a credit for over 100, you already give you a free 100 gigs out traffic, but now they give you a credit for over 100 gigs free if you want to move to another cloud or on-premise. Just like AWS, you do have to open a support case before you start the work, not after. You indicate when you will start and have 60 days from the point you say you'll start, and then you'll need to cancel all subscriptions associated with the account and then request the invoice credit. There are some fine details here, like you must provide that advance notice and cancel all Azure subscriptions, not just the one for the account you're trying to vacate, associated with your account after your data is transferred out before you can request your invoice level credit. And then you have to, so you open a support case, you do the thing, you delete all your subscriptions, and then you somehow open a support case telling them you'd like your credit. So I'm not sure how that works exactly. And they'd also like to point out that it doesn't cover all types of data transfer out, including ExpressRoute, VPN, Azure Front Door Service, and Azure CDN are not included in this credit offer. And if you have a partner, then Microsoft will let you to know, pound sand and talk to your partner instead, not us.
I mean, you can open a support case with no subscriptions because it's a different tier and everything, but
and it's so confusing. Also,
it's very, yeah.
Does your O365, if you still left your O365 there, yeah,
right?
Where's
you have to cancel that?
That's
too?
A different type of subscription, yeah. So,
right. So, does you have to cancel your entire O365 data and then your SharePoint and Teams?
This better be a lot of data,
like.
Yeah.
And then I'm sitting here going like, okay, if you're Azure CDN or Front Door, so I'm going to post all my private data in a Front Door bucket and then what? Download it through Azure Front Door, but that defeats the purpose of a CDN if I'm only downloading it once. So I have many questions about why they threw that one in there, but just have feelings about it.
Yeah.
I love in the step-by-step instructions that they link you to on this, and the qualifications, one of the qualifications is Azure might make changes regarding the egress credit policy in the future. Thank you for that, yeah, Microsoft. Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah. Like, yes, you didn't open the ticket on the proper number of days before you started the work, and so therefore we're not going to give you the credit. Where is that documented? Well, we changed the step-by-step procedure, so that's how you know.
Did Microsoft change their documentation and we had an issue with savings plans recently where it only supports V3, not V2. And that was magically updated from the time we opened the case until the time that we got the product group to inform us why we were not getting anything. So it doesn't surprise me that Microsoft will just update documentation without telling anyone.
Did they refund your credit, your savings plan for that?
See, or... it was on the list of things to do today, and then I decided that a Seve case would be more fun. Oh, okay. So I went with that.
Got it.
Good call.
I understand.
I mean, if it was AWS, though, you'd open the case after shutting down all of your stuff, and they'd say, sorry, your monthly billing has dropped below the threshold. you can't open, you're not entitled to open a case with us anymore. See ya.
Yeah.
Hi. And you have to leave the case open so you don't have to pay for Amazon support until you can actually.
All right. Well, Azure had a bunch of AKS updates. And since I'm always acknowledgedly horrified that people are using AKS, I'm going to start calling it AXE for my amazement. AXE updates this week. A general availability of Kubernetes 1.29. Windows Gen 2 VM support, which I don't know what Windows Gen 2s are, but they're supported now. Cost analysis add-on for AKS, so you know how much money you're going to burn on top of Kubernetes at all times. VM IP-based load balancer on Kubernetes, and instance-level public IP tags in AKS are all now generally available, or X. In public preview, you have two features, Kubernetes AI Toolchain Operator, or Kaito, add-on for AKS, because if you'd like to spend a lot of money on GPUs, well, do it with an automated toolchain to make it burn money while you're sleeping. And if you really want to burn money, they've also added public preview for Windows GPU support in AKS, because the best way to burn money is to run Windows containers with GPUs on top of Kubernetes in a very high egress traffic model. So you're welcome.
Whoa.
So Gen 2 is just their second generation. It's a load of SKUs of server types.
But why just Gen 2? If you just didn't you just mention Gen 3? Or V3, but aren't supported, or I'm so confused by Azure's naming. The Gen 2 is not the same as the V3 image type that you don't get the savings plan credit on. Is that how I'm supposed to follow that train of logic?
No, those are for app service plans, which is another service, which is just a different level of confusion.
Okay, we're going to move right on because it hurts my brain. Microsoft is apparently telling their investors to cool their jets on quick financial returns from Copilot. Testers apparently told the Wall Street Journal that they have mixed feelings about their usage of Copilot, and it justified the price tag of $30 per user per month. In fact, they even have a quote from Juniper Network CIO Sharon Mendel, who told the paper, they aren't ready to spend $30 per user yet because there's no value in it at that level. Sweet. Jared Spotero, CVP of Modern Work and Business Applications at Microsoft, said various applications are in different stages of development and that it's most effective when sophisticated information retrieval or sophisticated task completion is available in three areas, Office, Teams, and Outlook. And when more of these are finished with development, the price point will be more than justified. Which, thank you for releasing a pre-release software that isn't feature complete and doesn't have the value, but still charging me for it today. Thanks, Microsoft. Appreciate it.
I think the problem I have with this is the user model, right? I just don't know if that's the right model for this, because it does sort of just burn you up. And you know, it's, you want to make this a tool that's available. It is not something that you can clearly demonstrate a return on any kind of value yet. And then even to do an experiment, you end up paying just through the nose for something you don't know if you can use or not. And I just feel like it's the wrong model for this. And people want to play with the new shiny tool and they want to, you know, ask funny questions and they want it to write all their code functions and all those things. But until it's having a demonstrable value on the work product and you won't be able to justify this cost. So why do it per user?
Yeah, it's just, it's a toy right now.
Uh-huh.
And I think people are paying for they're paying to experiment with it. And I would imagine the price model will have to change because they've got to go with something. And $30 is probably, maybe it breaks even. Depends on the user, I guess, per user. But I think it ultimately will have to go to token-based billing like everybody else. Although
Then also they have a bunch of add-ons to it too. Because there's a security copilot that's going to be an add-on to the normal copilot. So, they are going to have, premium solutions and then, different tiers after that. It's going to be, again, go back to your trying to understand the billing model for, InfluxDB time stream. It's going to be that complicated.
Yeah, when you're going to train a model to do this work and then specifically exclude security features from it so you can charge extra for that, that's lame.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it really breaks the bundling thing because, for those of you who've been in the Microsoft licensing negotiation game for any time, you know that you used to be able to just buy things per user. Then they started doing these bundles. They call E3 and E5, and they're really expensive. And they're like, well, you get more value because you're bundling, and the bundles keep getting more products. And so, the bundle price will go up over time a little bit, but you're still getting continual value from the bundle. And you're like, okay, I don't like this model, but I can sort of understand it, and I'm getting future ROI. So, okay, cool. And then all this AI stuff come out, and they go, yeah, no, that's part of the bundle.
Yeah.
Pay extra for all of that. And that's when I go screw you, Microsoft.
Yeah.
At least create an E7 bundle or something. I don't know if that exists already, but because I never bought more than an E5. But, at least make a new bundle that includes these things versus, and give me a discounted rate to get them to show me the value. But, I look forward to seeing the sophisticated information retrieval and sophisticated task completions that these things will eventually do, because I personally am paying for this on my own personal 365 Office subscription on my home computer, and I'm not super impressed. So,
yeah.
Compared to Google Docs, where I'm paying the $30 a price because the CloudPod has a workspace. Hey, if anyone from Google wants to send us some credits, I'd love them. you know, we pay for real licenses here. And so I have it enabled for myself, but not for Jonathan or Matt or Ryan. So sorry, guys. But $30 user per month is a little steep for the CloudPod. Yeah. Yeah, it'd be nice to be able to make that available to everybody. So anyways, moving on. Microsoft has committed a bit of a Lion King move here, and I only say that because this person's name is Mustafa, which is very close to Mustafa. It's really nothing. They've apparently hired away Mustafa Suleiman and Karen Simonon to join the new organization called Microsoft AI, which I think isn't that new, because I think that's what they tried to create with Sam Altman, but then didn't go forward with. So it's back. And this is focused on advancing Copilot and their own consumer AI products and research, and hopefully maybe making money. So Wall Street will not have to cool their jets too long. Mustafa will be the EVP and CEO of Microsoft AI and report directly to Satya Nadella. Karen is joining the group as chief scientist, reporting to Mustafa. And Mustafa is the founder of both DeepMind and Inflection AI, and is a visionary product maker and builder of pioneering teams. Karen was the co-founder at Inflection and was the lead in developing some of the largest AI breakthroughs over the past decade, including AlphaZero. Several other members of the Inflection team have joined as well, and the Copilot, Bing Edge team, Bing Edge and Teams and Gen AI team will now report to Mustafa as well. Although Kevin Scott, the CTO and EVP of AI, is responsible for all AI strategy at Microsoft, including all system architecture decisions, partnerships, and cross-company arbitration, will continue in his current role, I think, reporting to Satya. And you might be asking yourself, well, what happened to Inflection AI? That was my first question. You can go read a very vague blog post that says basically they're abandoning its ChatGPT challenger, which is known as Pi, and will be announcing new future software sales they'll be doing with their new CEO they hired after Mustafa ran to Microsoft. So I guess we'll see what's going to happen with Inflection AI. It was not clear in the blog post to me, other than I do know now they are a Microsoft partner and they will be running the Inflection 2.5 platform on top of Azure in the future. So, yeah, not exactly sure exactly what's going on here and why Microsoft just didn't buy them. But, you know, here we are.
Yeah, that is a kind of a weird move.
Well, they have dead, probably.
My guess is they're dead.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
But, you know, I did try out their Pi, you know, their AI, and its claim to fame is that it talks to me, which I don't know. It was sort of unnerving. So as you chat with a chatbot on Pi, you had to choose a chat AI voice that you'd like it to use. And as you're talking, as you're typing to it, it's talking back to you, which is a very awkward conversational model.
Please no. Yeah.
I assume Pi is dead. I assume this new CEO is there to sell whatever technology they can sell out of the business to get their investors to be whole. But why they just didn't sell the whole company to Microsoft makes no sense to me.
I love that the CTO is and EVP of AI.
Right.
Like, that's a very funny title to me. I don't know why.
Microsoft titles don't make much sense. Like banks.
Yeah. Do they have multiple CTOs?
Yes. There's a CTO for Azure, there's a CTO for AI, there's a CTO for different parts of business.
I guess that's not that bad. Yeah.
Yeah, just say, wasn't Warner the CTO of AWS and not Amazon?
No, he's Amazon, not AWS.
I have it the other way around.
Yeah. Which seems like he does mostly AWS stuff, but maybe that's just my impression from hearing him talking at reInvent.
Yeah.
And then the last Microsoft announcement for this week is they're open sourcing a new container network observability tool called Retina. The tool provides actionable network insights for cloud native applications and helps you troubleshoot latency, packet drops, and many more things. It's non-intrusive and easy to use and supports diverse environments as long as they're containers.
Cool. So like, just go a whole different way with your observability platform than everyone else. And well, because you had to, because that's the only thing that'll support Windows containers. All right.
Yeah, most likely. Traffic insights, eBPF, metric and flow logs, distributed packet capturing, any CNI, any Kubernetes platform is the promise of Retina. We'll see what kind of traction it gets in the market. But
yeah. Well, I mean, the probably none, which is why they're open sourcing it, right? As a product, like from ECS has become the standard.
I mean, I'm sure it'll be first citizen in AKS or AX.
Not intrusive and easy to use. Heard that before.
Show me where it hurts.
Yeah.
Non-intrusive at all. Yeah. Collect customizable telemetry, which can be exported to multiple storage options such as Prometheus, Azure Monitor, and other vendors, and visualize a variety of ways, including Grafana, Azure Log Analytics, and other vendors. And this just sounds like a great way to spend a lot of money.
It's
quickly.
A funnel for data and other services.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, for, that's the Prometheus play on in Kubernetes. So it makes total sense, but it's just sort of like, okay.
I see you're really sold on this one.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know the rough spots of using Axe. So, I mean, that's the thing. This might solve a real problem. I just haven't used that platform.
Do you use Axe, Matthew?
I have used AKS. I don't use that in my day job. I mean, it seemed to work in my experience no different than any of the other, you know, EKS or GKE. So it just kind of worked, and some of Azure stuff was a little bit behind, but it seems like they're mostly caught up at this point.
Sweet. All right. Well, that's it for this week's news, guys. Hopefully your Sev 8, Matt, goes better. And I think I have a Sev 1 opening up right now as I speak. So your karma is just spreading around the call. So we appreciate it, Matt.
Anytime. Glad I can help.
We'll see you next week.
See you later.
Bye, everybody.
And that is The Week in Cloud. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can join our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet us with the hashtag #PoundTheCloudPod. All right. Well, let's talk about an Aperture topic. Linux is just really letting me down. And it's letting me down in the serious way that, you know, most NoSQL solutions let me down until they get a SQL interface. And then they solve all my problems. I can write all my code as SQL. Everything's great. And you know what I was thinking? What if I could add SQL to my operating system? Wouldn't that be awesome? A distributed SQL layer on my operating system? Would you guys be into that?
I feel like you're trolling me because of all the harassment for running SQL on Kubernetes.
Well, now, Ryan, I can run SQL on Kubernetes on top of a database for my hosts.
Oh, God.
That's what I'm excited to talk to you about. So this announcement I found earlier in the week, and then Matt found this morning as well. But Turing Award laureate, Dr. Mike Stonebreaker, loves to invent databases, being one of the inventors of the first relational database, Ingres, over 40 years ago, followed by PostgreSQL 30 years ago. And more recently, he co-created an in-memory transactional database you might have heard of called VaultDB. And now, his latest startup is looking to replace the entire cloud-native computing stack with database as an operating system, DBOS. The claim is Linux is too old and Kubernetes is too complicated and that a database can replace all of them and simplify everything. And he's raised $8.5 million to do such a thing with the Apache Spark creator and Databricks co-founder, CTO Matai Zaharia, and a joint team from MIT and Stanford to create DBOS. The DBOS runs all the operating system services on top of a high-performance distributed database, all state logs, and other system data restored in SQL-accessible tables. The result is a scalable, fault-tolerant, and cyber-resilient serverless compute cloud for cloud-native apps. With an OS atop of the distributed database, you get fault tolerance, multi-node scaling, and state management. Observability and security gets easier. Today's distributed systems are largely built on OS designed to run on a single server, but in the DBOS design, a high-performance distributed OLTP would implement a suite of OS services and would run a minimal OS kernel with support for memory management, device drivers, interrupt handlers, and basic types tasks of byte management. And you may be asking yourself, well, this must be using VaultDB. And no, you'd be wrong, because they wanted an open source key value system. So they use foundational DB. And then you say to yourself, well, they must have written a brand new kernel to run all that magic. No, they've stolen Amazon's Firecracker, which is available for developers today as the first functional functions as a service platform built on top of DBOS on top of Firecracker, because it's turtles all the way down.
That is truly spectacular.
I feel like this should be an April Fool's joke.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's 2 weeks too early.
Yeah. I mean, I want to use this. I don't know, like, if it's like a in a sort of what they call those monks that beat themselves kind of way, but I love the idea. I think this is probably snake oil, but
How could you? How could you fault a man who's built every SQL database known to man for 40 years? How would you call this something snake oil? I can't believe you'd say
that. Well, because I've met a lot of SQL admins and they use SQL for everything and they shouldn't.
In our earlier conversation about SQL stored procedures, you'll know that you can store any business logic you want to in a stored procedure, and it's amazing. And if I can make all of my Linux tasks and stored procedures in a DBOS, I am there.
I think the things to like about
it. Remind me not to work for Justin.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is things to like about it. There's a lot of marketing junk to filter out of the whole thing. Obviously, they're trying to justify what they're building. There's some stuff to like about
$8.5 million in investment.
That's not a lot, though, in the grand scheme of things. But I think like building an operating system that's designed, or you know, or at least considers the fact that it's going to be working in a cluster, and have that be part of the OS and not be part of the app layer, is potentially really useful, because that offloads complexity from applications. So that's kind of nice. But honestly, I mean, they're using a Linux kernel, Linux microkernel.
But Linux is too old, remember.
Well, they said, I Googled it. It says they're using Linux.
No, they're using Firecracker.
Linux on Firecracker, yeah.
But it's just funny because they tell you Linux is too old and Kubernetes is too complicated. And so we built a thing on top of a Linux kernel. Like,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. I don't know.
Like which part?
Yeah.
The idea that, you know, if transactions are interrupted or if any kind of activity is interrupted, it can resume on another node. It's all nice. It's all very honorable.
Just build things to be more stateless.
It's sort of weird that they, you know, serverless is their first use case, and that, you know, their whole complaint is that it's hard to do recovery and resiliency. And so they're, you know, if you go to their website, dbos.dev, and you happen to go to the pricing page, it says DBOS Cloud and has a bunch of checkboxes and included words versus other serverless. And so like the first one is scalable serverless computing. Both of them have checkboxes. Cool, cool. Fault tolerant workflows with guaranteed once and only once execution included, not available on other services. Really? Because that's not my experience. Built-in state management. Okay, I'll give you that. Time travel debugging. Okay, maybe. Scalable serverless computing. Both of them really have that. But you're saying you don't. SQL accessible observability data. I don't know that I ever wanted that. And then cyber resilience is included, but not included in serverless. So even that's a little suspect to me. It is sort of interesting.
I don't know anybody who'd want to use this.
You don't want to sign up for a free trial? And
other than for novelty. I mean, it's the kind of like janky thing that you find, you know, you're playing through a video game like Half-Life and you come across this ancient bunker that's got this computer system. And it's like, this ancient computer system uses a database on top of an operating system to do this stuff. And like, okay, this makes a great story for a fiction game that never has a place in real life.
I kind of felt that way the first time I used containers, though, like, and moving from BSD jails to containers. And so it's sort of like, I don't understand why this is better, but now I do. And so like, I agree with you. It's a novelty right now, but I also like, I have this, but what if it's not sort of,
I mean, the thing about running apps on Linux is that like everything's built in layers. So great. You built this resilience into the kernel instead of building it at a layer down. Like that doesn't inherently make it more reliable or less reliable than having it further down in the app stack. I mean, I don't understand where they really see the value in moving it to where it is versus having it just be, you know, built into the service that's running in the first place.
I got it. You can run your stateful service on here and it magically has high availability.
It kind of looks like it.
That's what they're trying to tell you.
That's, I mean, because that's the whole point behind the Linux kernel, right? Because otherwise you'd have to have every app custom written for those things. So like, it makes sense. But I don't, like, it doesn't really get rid of the concerns, I don't think. Because like, or maybe it does, and I just can't visualize it because I haven't used it. Like,
yeah. I mean, probably the worst thing about this announcement is that this function as a service thing they shipped only supports TypeScript. And I hate TypeScript. Uh-huh. So trying to parse through their code of like examples, and I'm just like, oh, I can't get past the TypeScript code examples. I'm like, can you do any language other than TypeScript?
Yeah, I mean, call us back when there's a CrowdStrike agent or a Qualys agent or any of the other agents that
that security requires you to run.
That's required to run on top of this. It's never going to happen.
But what if it can't?
No, I know.
It will.
If it can. Okay, we should have like a CloudPod follow-up calendar just to remind us, like in 12 months' time, let's see where DBOS is in the market.
We have a Google Workspace. This should be possible.
Yeah, we should do that.
If only we paid for a subscription to Google Workspaces for all the CloudPod hosts manage our calendars.
We should do like a this time last year section where we just look at an interesting story from last year and see quite where that is. I mean,
we kind of do that when we do the end of year review. We look back and when like this one comes up and someone's be like, oh yeah, we talked about that DBOS thing. What happened to that? I'm like, I mean, it happened.
Yeah.
But all right. Well, I was intrigued. I'm curious about it. I'm not ready to give them my monies in any way, shape, or form. But and if I knew how to write TypeScript, maybe I would try their free tier, but I don't. So,
you're paying for Copilot, so you can say write this TypeScript.
That's true. I can, but
in some usable language.
Like, don't make this easy for me, Ryan, because I'm trying to have excuses not to do it. all right, guys. Well, we'll talk next week. Good luck on your outage, Matt. Hope it goes.
Get some sleep, man.
Yeah.
Why? I look wide awake. I don't know what you're talking about.
You look great.
How many cups of coffee are you on? 12?
Zero. I don't drink coffee.
What? Who let you be a host on the CloudPod?
I drink a lot of tea.
Don't we vet this?
No.
I mean, he does drink alcohol with us, so it's okay.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
I was going to say, between the alcohol and I'm the only person that is insane enough to deal with Azure, he kind of just stuck with me here.
Yeah.
I mean, how much value is it added to the show that you do Azure? I don't know. I mean, it's just fun to have you. It's not really about the Azure stuff. Like, I mean, that's the joke I go with, but like, it's like having you here. It's fun.
Yeah. So.
It's a different perspective because you came from the partner side where I shunned all partnering things. So that's good.
Yeah. Well, next week we'll be like, Matt's not here this week to talk about all the amazing Azure stuff.
Yeah. I mean, there was a couple weeks ago. I don't know if you caught that episode, but there was some announcement about LLMs and AI GPUs. And we were like, and if Jonathan was here, he would tell you how amazing this is. And we have no idea. So we're going to move right along.
Yep.
We know who's the experts in different topics here on the show. So
I got Azure. I'm not happy about that one.
you can have Azure and something else. You're just gonna pick what you want. So
yeah.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye, everyone. See ya.